All right, time to start. That clock is 5 minutes off, at least according to my atomic watch, which I'm inclined to trust as a believer in high technology and a disbeliever in school administrative organizations. I wanted to remind you that you're supposed to have a draft of your paper to me in about a month, by April 8th. That's in order that we can then use paper drafts as material for classroom discussions for the final chunk of the class. If you don't have a paper started yet, or at least decided on, you're a bit behind things, so I suggest you should do so. One thing that occurred to me that it might be appropriate for somebody in the great state of California to do a paper on that I don't think I've ever had is vigilantes. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history, but the Committee of Vigilance was a San Francisco institution which basically arose more or less spontaneously according to its supporters because the official police were letting murderers go because the murderers were friends of them, of theirs essentially, and more or less took over for I'm not sure how long, I think more than a year, maybe longer than that. And if I remember correctly, I think the people who were responsible for the vigilantes ended up as major political figures in California for a fair while later in the 19th century. Yeah? Neat.
It was back in the 20s, several prostitutes participated in the last public lynching in California.
Uh-huh. But that's a vigilanteism in the broad sense, but it's not the Committee of Vigilance. It's not the actual historical episode. And the only reason I know anything about it is that when I was a faculty fellow in Chicago, at somehow, I don't remember how, I stumbled across a chunk of the bookcases in the library there, which was a bunch of articles on the vigilante movement. And part of the fun of it, when you started reading the books, was that some of the authors thought the vigilantes were the bad guys, and some of them thought they were the good guys. And so you got the same sequence of historical events told from two very different angles. And, yep?
So you're talking about a specific movement?
Yes, I'm talking about a specific movement. There have been other such movements, so it wouldn't have to be that one. That's just the one that I know about and the most famous one. And I don't remember exactly when it was. It was California, I think, a little after the Gold Rush period, if I remember correctly, but some point, 1850 maybe. I think it was before the Civil War, but I'm not really sure. This was 20 years ago that I was reading up on it. But I just thought it was an interesting episode. And I think it was organized enough so that somebody I'm thinking of any of you who haven't thought of any ideas for a paper of what possibilities are out there, and that would be one fun one. But I also,
I have a question about the paper.
Yeah. Or anthropology, or all sorts of things, yeah?
The citation formats that you expect on the paper,
I don't really care. If you're doing it for your legal writing requirement, then you're supposed to be in touch with me early on and go through whatever you do, and then I suppose you ought to use law school, standard law formats. But as far as I'm concerned, all I really care is that from the citation, somebody can find the source. And how you do it is not of great importance. Anyway, that was one that occurred to me that would be sort of fun to do, but I thought I would take the opportunity, since some of you may have thought of two different paper ideas and only be doing one of them, to see if any of you had what occurred to you as neat ideas for other people to do papers on, as sort of a free resource for the class. Anybody here have suggestions for papers that they'd like to have somebody do and aren't doing themselves? No. There is no legal system in the history of the world that you are curious about learning about it. All right, well, if you do think of them, mention it, because there's no reason why good ideas shouldn't be shared. I have one page on my website, which is ideas for short stories I'm not going to write. They're basically things where I thought I had a clever idea, I didn't really have a story to go with the clever idea, and at this point I think I've had two or three people write stories from those ideas and send them to me. With their permission, I added them to the webpage. I thought that was sort of a neat kind of collaboration. That when you're young, you're afraid that people will steal your ideas. And as you get older, you're afraid people won't steal your ideas. I've gotten to that stage quite a while back. Now, I do object to a number of scholars who were so rude as to steal my ideas and publish them before I had them, but that's a special case. All right. You've now read my article on 18th century criminal law, and I include the article in the course. I'm cheating a little bit because it really is getting close to our legal system. It's only, you know, a couple of hundred years ago and a small ocean away, and historically it is English common law, which is basically what we are. And I put it in because I thought it was a really interesting case and I knew quite a lot about it. It was one of the reasons I created this course, was having found it productive to try to figure out that system. So what comments, questions do people have from reading that piece? What puzzled you or interested you, or do you think you had to add about that? Yep.
So the clerical offenses?
Yes.
Essentially, kill someone a certain way, you get away with just branding on the thumb.
When you say a certain way, I don't know enough of the details of the law at the time to tell you what did or didn't count. But I think it also depends when. I think theoretically in 1200 or 1300, when there still were real church courts operating, if you were actually a clergyman and murdered somebody, you could not be executed. You might, however, have 2 years of bread and water as a penance imposed on you by the church court. So that essentially, when the system starts, you've really got a sort of a divided legal authority between the church and the state. And the church takes the position that the legal authority over its people belongs to it, not to the king. So at that point, if you commit a clergyable offense, and if you can successfully plead benefit of clergy, you end up getting whatever the church's sentence is rather than the king's sentence for that offense. And as time goes on, one of the things happens is the church courts essentially vanish. I think they still may be relevant to some things like marriages, but for most purposes they vanish. And the definition of clergy gets broader and broader until eventually it's anybody who wants to claim benefit of clergy. And so there is a period when, in theory, you can commit some things that would otherwise be capital offenses, claim benefit of clergy, which might require memorizing the neck verse and reciting it to prove you read Latin even though you don't, or a little bit later doesn't even require that, get branded on the thumb, maybe imprisoned for a while before your trial, which could be pretty unpleasant, and then turned loose. I think that's right. Yep.
To me, it certainly is very unfair, though, later. Mm. They said, well, if you can show that you're literate, then that's enough to convert you to this.
That's right.
It seems like that's a very blatant class distinction that seems difficult to reconcile with any fairness.
Yeah, I doubt that they were thinking of fairness principle. I think they were thinking of it just as the fact that it's not particularly fair that if you park illegally in New York and happen to be a member of the embassy of some country, you aren't going to have to pay the ticket because you've got immunity as a member of the... legally speaking, you're sort of not entirely under the authority of the city of New York. And this is coming out of a system like that, in that they were thinking of clergymen as, in some sense, not in the same chain of command as everybody else.
Isn't the ratio a little different? Because few people
are
embassy.
Yes.
But a lot of people by that time in England could read, so it really seems like a penalty on people who are...
Depends on what time. At the point when the doctrine is originally coming in, then clergy are going to be a very small minority. By the 18th century, there's no requirement at all, so everybody is covered. In between that, there is a point at which you are supposed to show you are literate on the theory that, probably you can read Latin, I think, on the theory that that is evidence you're a clergyman because they're the educated class. It sounds as though for a while the demonstration can be a fake demonstration, so everybody accepts that, so you just memorize a particular chunk of Latin of Latin text and recite it. But no, I don't think it was ever intended to be fair. It was intended to be recognized initially, to be recognizing the existence of, as it were, a dual sovereignty between the church and the state over different people. And then it sort of evolved, more or less by accident, the way a lot of things often do in legal systems. And, you know, it would be an interesting question to ask, if it was more than accident, to ask whether, as the system developed, there were reasons why people wanted to have it there. And the answer is, I just don't know. But no, I don't think that fairness was something to aim at. Yeah? Yes.
And they got a pardon from someone intervening.
Yes.
Class. Was that like
No, it isn't a guarantee. It's a possibility. Long after I wrote the article, I came across a fascinating description that's actually describing this kind of process. Have any of you heard of James Boswell? He's famous mostly for writing possibly the most famous biography in English literature, Boswell's biography of Life of Johnson, Samuel Johnson, who did the famous early dictionary and various other things. And it turned out, someone discovered, I think, in the early 20th century, that Boswell had kept what was essentially a diary for a large part of his life, and most of it had survived. And that eventually got published, Boswell's memoirs, what I suppose must be 8 or 10 volumes, something like that. Boswell was a Scottish lawyer. He didn't want to be a Scottish lawyer. He wanted to be a young aristocrat, but that wasn't really an option. His father was a moderately wealthy and high-status person, roughly, I think, the equivalent of a Supreme Court justice in Scotland by the end of his career. And Boswell sort of had literary pretensions. He wanted to go to London and join some elite regiment where you wouldn't have to really do anything but have an excuse for hanging around London and socializing with educated people and stuff. And there was a running sort of fight between him and his father for many, many years over what his father wanted him to do, which was to be a Scottish lawyer, and what Boswell wanted to do. And Boswell gave in to the extent of, in fact, qualifying as a Scottish lawyer, though he was never very happy with it. And his first criminal case involved a man who was accused of sheep stealing. Actually, possession of stolen sheep. I think the man was a butcher, but somehow he had sheep in his possession, one of which was stolen. And Boswell succeeded in getting him off. And shortly thereafter, some prominent judge, I think, in another case, referred to this acquittal as an obvious miscarriage of justice due to a basically smooth-talking lawyer persuading the jury to let off a guy who was obviously guilty. Many years later, the same client is a second time charged with sheep stealing under more or less similar circumstances. And Boswell tries to get him off and fails. And Boswell then moves heaven and earth to try to get the guy a pardon. And Boswell knows a lot of important people. He's not an important person himself in that sense. By this time, I think he's written one book that's gotten quite a lot of attention, not the Life of Johnson, but an earlier book that's now forgotten. But he knew, the Duchess of so-and-so and the Countess of so-and-so. He sort of had been a minor figure in London society and social circles, as it were. And so he wrote to all his important friends trying to get them to petition for a pardon. And some of them did petition. But it turned out that the judge, the same judge who had made this comment, whatever, 20 years earlier or something, was also pressuring on the other side and was more or less threatening to resign if they pardoned this obviously guilty person the second time around. And the result was he was hanged. So it was an intriguing case because I sort of tried to make sense of it theoretically a long time ago when I wrote this article. And here you had a first-hand description of the process where Boswell was doing it, I suspect, partly for emotional reasons. This had been his first client. He sort of half persuaded himself the guy was innocent, although it's pretty clear reading the memoirs that Boswell is never really sure if he's innocent or not. And Boswell was sort of the person who persuaded himself to be emotionally committed to various things at various times in his life. But it's clear that none of the people he was petitioning really had any basis for asking to have the guy pardoned. It was just that they were influential people, they were doing a favor for a friend, essentially. So in that sense, you could see the kind of process that I was guessing at when I wrote that article actually working out in Scotland, not in England, but under the same basic, under the same king by this time, of course. So the same logic. So I don't think there's any guarantee to it, but I think what's true, and I suspect that whether it worked would depend on things like how horrible did the crime seem to be, how plausible was it that this was not really a serious criminal, but just a guy who got drunk and, broke into somebody's house or got drunk and stole a sheep or something. But as I interpret it at least, one of the things that would be relevant would be whether you get important people to try to support you, to try to ask the judge to pardon you. Actually, I think the king actually pardons you theoretically. It just comes through the judge, if I've got it right. So that's at least my reading the system. Now, I hope it's clear in the article, there's a lot of conjecture in that article. I mean, we don't have the kind of information you would have if you were researching law in the U.S. at present, and even if we did, I'm not a professional 18th century historian, so there's probably stuff out there I don't know about, like Boswell when I originally wrote the thing. But anyway, that's what seems to be going on. But it did seem to me intriguing in trying to understand that pardon system. We have pardons too, of course, but the fact that of the people, in one group of courts for which somebody actually did a study, that of the people who were convicted of capital felonies, only for capital, I guess capital felonies in general, only about 40% of them were hanged. And that's sort of striking, given that hanging was the only sentence you could give for that. And if a war was going on, it makes sense that they would say, look, we need sailors for the Navy, it's a pretty bad job, so we'll tell these guys, look, if you don't want to hang, join the Navy. People do it with the Marines in America more recently, I gather, though not for hanging, generally for less serious offenses. And of course, there's transportation to the New World, which is important at that time. But it's clear that there were also a noticeable number of people who were just pardoned. And as I suggest in the article, one way of reading it is that you're saying, look, he's not going to do it again. It really was just sort of we've scared him. We've told him you're going to hang by the neck until dead. That's going to be enough. We don't have to actually carry it through. But another interpretation is that it's a way in which you can, in effect, pay a fine in exchange for not getting hanged, where the fine is not in a direct cash payment, but in sort of political transfers of various sorts. And it's not clear, you know, it seems like an unfair system does, but you might argue, look, who is the person whose friends will go to bat for him? He's the kind of person we don't want to hang. Who is the person whose friends will say, well, you know, it was nice knowing you. He's the first you want to hang. So I'm not, I in a sense find it less interesting to say is this a just or an unjust system than to say is it a functional system? Does it achieve objectives that the people involved might have wanted to achieve? Yeah? Yes?
One of your arguments that one of the breakdown, the reasons for the breakdown of the system was the declining availability of, you know, being able to send people to the U.S. or to Australia.
It depends which part of the system, as you've got a bunch of different features of this system. And I don't think that explains why you shift from private prosecution to public prosecution. But I think that one possible explanation of the shift to using imprisonment, which is just coming in the late 18th century, and which we think of as the normal system, as it were, is that you couldn't send people to the New World because there was this unpleasantness starting in 1776, and they wouldn't take them, basically, thereafter. Some of the colonies refused to take them even earlier than that. And eventually they got Australia, and they used Australia for that purpose. But Australia is much farther away, and so it was a much bigger project and more costly to ship people over there. And I don't know, that is the... We know what it cost them to transport people to the New World. Because it was £3, I think I've got the figure in the paper. That was the subsidy they had to give to get the shipmasters to be willing to carry convicts, basically. And I don't know why, I don't know enough about the later Australian episode to know what the equivalent figure would have been there. Incidentally, one of the sort of minor details that shows up in there, but that's historically interesting, is the business of auctioning off indentured servants. That is, that what's happening in the case of transporting people who've been pardoned on condition of agreeing to be transported, what they've agreed to is to be sold as temporary slaves in the New World. And that was done by a straight auction. They arrive, who will pay me the most for X years, for 7 years, for 14 years, depending on the circumstances of this person's labor. But what you may or may not be aware is that the same kind of thing was happening in an entirely private basis, I think well into the early 19th century, as a way in which people paid their fare to get here. So if you were somebody in Europe who desperately wanted to come to the New World and had no money, you made a deal with a ship captain, and the deal was the ship captain would charge, let us say, £5 to transport you to the New World. In exchange, when you arrived in the New World, he would have a reverse auction, in the sense that he would say, I want £5, who will give me £5 for the shortest length of indentured servitude? All right, so if you say, well, I'll offer you £5 if I can have this guy's work for 4 years, the ship captain, will anybody lower that to 3? And that was, in fact, a way in which people who didn't have the money for transportation got to quite a lot of the people who got to the New World. And it's an interesting case because most of us have this gut-level feeling that slavery is wrong. On the other hand, this was a case in which you could certainly argue very persuasively that the existence of that institution was a good thing. It meant that people who really wanted to come to America and would have lived miserable lives if they'd stayed where they were got the chance to come here at the cost of 2 or 3 years of of labor, of essentially slave labor. Yep. Well, you can go bankrupt, and an indentured servant can't go bankrupt.
Well, yeah, but it's very, very.
Well, yeah, there may be cases in which you can't, and you also have a choice of your employment. But no, I think it's true that that slavery sounds like an all or nothing thing, but really, real human institutions are much more continuous than that. Some systems that we would think of as unquestionably slavery, slaves had some rights that, you know, you couldn't automatically kill your slave. I don't know what was true in the American South, but I'm thinking of, you know, classical antiquity and saga period Iceland and various other systems. It was not uncommon, at least, that there were some legal restrictions on what you could do with regard to your slave. And similarly, as you say, our institutions, to some degree, you can commit yourself to things. And of course, all of us, everybody in this room, is subject to involuntary slavery because all of us could be summoned for jury duty. All right, jury duty is a form of slavery in the literal sense. Somebody is saying, here is a job you must do, not because you've agreed to take it, but because we will punish you if you don't. It's very short-term slavery, not a very unpleasant slavery, but it nonetheless is, I think, aside from, you know, the fact that people like it and don't call it that, it really is. And of course, the draft was a much more serious, the military draft was a much more serious form of slavery that fortunately got ended, I think. Yeah, although we tend, I think, to make a distinction, and it's not for a sharp distinction, but a distinction between seizing your labor and seizing property, wealth, fruit of your labor, and so forth. And it's sort of a blurry distinction that, you know, as in the case of a loan, you can certainly imagine a monetary, if you imagine that the government says we're going to tax able-bodied young men in order to staff the military, and we're going to set the tax so high that a sufficient number of people have to volunteer to join the military where we will pay them because they'd starve to death otherwise you're paying the tax. That would be a case where the tax starts blurring into slavery. But anyway, it strikes me that the whole business of indentured servitude is an interesting historical episode for people who think they have very clear moral intuitions about what contracts ought to be enforced, because that really was a contract that involved selling yourself into temporary slavery.
I thought it was interesting when you discussed the whole private deterrent aspect and how merchants can join the association.
Yes.
To commit to prostitution.
Yes.
And you were saying how that was more less of an insurance thing, more of a motivation to convey the message to those who might want to that we're committed to prostitution. And I just thought that was an interesting way of.
Yeah, well, obviously I can't be certain I'm right, but it struck me that people had just gotten it wrong because they hadn't thought. I mean, commitment is a general interesting problem. That is, that because it's not uncommon to be in a situation where you want to have to do something, but you don't want to do it, as it were. You know, the famous story is Ulysses tying himself to the mast, that, you know, people know that in the Odyssey, the sirens sing incredibly sweetly, and so men jump off their ships and drown. And so how does Ulysses get past the sirens? He puts wax in the ears of all of his sailors so they can't hear the sirens. But Ulysses is a hero. He's not going to do that. He wants to hear this incredibly sweet music, so he has his sailors tie him to the mast and not put wax in his ears. That's a commitment strategy. All right, and you can think of a lot of other things which sort of look like commitment strategies. If you have marriage laws where it is impossible or very costly to get out of a marriage, that's a legal mechanism for committing yourself. If you have a Christmas club where you want to save money and you set it up so the bank automatically transfers a certain amount of money each month into a special account, it's not a very strong commitment strategy. You probably could break it in some way, but it's a commitment strategy nonetheless. And you can think of lots of other things that people do that really can be seen as commitment strategies. If you think about labor union bargaining, you're the CEO of a company, you're bargaining with the labor union, you know that there is an offer you would like, which they would accept if they believed they could get nothing better. So you make a public statement saying, certainly our company cannot afford to pay a penny more than X dollars. My board of directors ought to fire me if I agree to anything more than that. Well, if you do it well enough so that it really is risky to agree to something more, then the union says, well, yesterday we could have pushed him further, but now he's nailed his colors to the mast, and now we're going to have to accept that. So that kind of behavior, it seems to me, is an interesting feature of human behavior, and one of the things, when you're trying to understand why he will do things, one of the possibilities to think about is that it's a concern. And this is obviously an example. But it's also interesting because we tend to take it for granted that deterrence has to be something done for everybody. And it really isn't, because if you think about, for a moment, abstracting away from criminal law, just think about ordinary human behavior. One of the things some people do is to make it clear, look, I'm an SOB. You mess with me, and whatever it takes, I'm going to get you. All right, that's a human strategy. It's a costly strategy, especially running to another SOB, lock horns, but at the same time, it can be a very successful strategy if it results in people not messing with you. And some of that may be sort of committing yourself emotionally, and some of it may be getting a situation where you'll suffer external costs, where you'll lose face, essentially, if you don't carry it through. And as I think I may have suggested earlier, the whole idea, when we say people do things because they're vengeful, well, as an economist, I want rational models of human behavior, and I say, well, being vengeful is rational in some circumstances. Because if you're known to be vengeful, people don't mess with you. Now, of course, if they do mess with you and you've got to carry through on being vengeful, you might get killed in the process. So it's not a costless strategy. It's not always a sensible strategy. There's some advantages to being a wimp. But there are also some real costs. If any of you are into evolutionary biology, which probably none of you are, although it's a fascinating subject, there's something referred to as hawk-dove equilibrium in evolutionary biology, in which the model is you imagine a bird, two variants of the same species of bird, and we're going to call one a hawk and one a dove, thinking of hawk in the metaphorical sense that we use in a political sense, somebody who's warlike. And the difference between a hawk and a dove appears when they both see the same piece of food. That a hawk will go for the food and will fight another bird that tries to take it away from him. A dove will go for the food but will back off if another bird tries for it. And if you think through sort of the mathematics of hawk-dove equilibrium, you've got a benefit to being a hawk, which is that you get the food more often. You've got a cost to being a hawk, which is if the other bird happens to also be a hawk, you have a fight and one or both of you get hurt. If there are almost no hawks, then being a hawk is profitable, because you hardly ever run into another hawk. If there are lots of hawks, then being a dove is profitable, and therefore there is some equilibrium percentage of hawks in the population, at which the two are equally attractive, which in an evolutionary biological sense means at which they're equally reproductively successful, so the number of both of them stays the same. And you can apply that, in a couple of my books, sort of, in working through various ideas, I apply that to human societies, and I'm thinking there of what we think of as aggressive personalities, as being hawks. And being an aggressive personality can be very profitable, provided there aren't very many others of them. This actually started a very, very long time ago, probably before most of you were born, actually, when there was a workshop at UCLA, where I was a professor at the time, in which somebody was arguing that you couldn't use rational behavior as a model for human behavior, and the example he gave is two guys in a bar who get into an argument over football teams, and when it's over, one of them is lying dead on the floor, and the other one is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face saying, "What have I done?" And Earl Thompson, who was still a professor at UCLA, and I both leaped up simultaneously. Of course it's rational behavior. It's a doomsday machine going off. Doomsday machine is an idea that came out of nuclear strategy, which is the idea, another commitment idea, which is that the way you defend the U.S. is you take a bunch of bombs, nuclear bombs, so dirty that they'll kill everything on Earth. You bury them conveniently in the Rocky Mountains, where it's much easier than having to deliver them to Russia. Right? You then have a triggering device such that if there's a nuclear attack on the U.S., they'll go off. And you tell the Russians about it. You say, now we're safe. They can't attack us, they'll kill everybody. That's a commitment strategy. What famous film is about that particular strategy? Dr. Strangelove is one where the Russians have a doomsday machine, but they've put off announcing it because they want it to celebrate the premier's birthday. And unfortunately, shortly before they announce it, a crazy U.S. Air Force officer launches an attack on the Soviet Union. But that's the same basic set of ideas. So it's a useful set of ideas for making sense of the world, I think. I should say, by the way, that Dr. Strangelove, the plot is stolen from a novel called Red Alert, which I think is a better story, because in that one, the Air Force officer isn't crazy. He's acting in a way which, although it's going to result in a whole lot of people dying, he doesn't know about the Doomsday Machine, is in some sense defensible. That is, he's somebody who was in Eastern Europe when the Russians came in at the end of World War II and saw horrible things happen. His professional calculation is the U.S. is gradually slipping behind, and if nothing is done pretty soon, the Russians will be able to conquer us, but that a first strike will work now. And so he rigs it so that his very large Air Force wing is going to go in. He then notifies the rest of the Air Force, you can't stop these boys, you'd better come in behind them. And he then commits suicide in order to make sure that nobody can force him to recall his people. So it's really, I think, a much more serious story than Dr. Strange, where he's just a nut on them. You know, it wasn't supposed to be a serious movie. It was supposed to be a sort of a black comedy kind of movie. Anyway, long digression. Maybe interesting. Other comments, questions, things about it? I don't know if I've mentioned before, I don't think it's in the article, I don't think I knew it at the time, but with regard to the question, that one of the problems that you run into, I sort of discussed earlier that one of the interesting issues running through a whole lot of stuff is the incentive to prosecute. And one of the problems you have to worry is too much incentive to prosecute as well as too little, and that's my sort of story, for my poster boy for that, is the mid-18th century in England, when they set up very large rewards for certain kinds of, for committing people certain kinds of crimes. And rewards which are sort of comparable to $100,000, thus, that kind of amount of money. And it turned out that people were either being convicted of crimes that hadn't occurred on perjured testimony to get the reward, or that people were being tricked into committing crimes in order that they could then be betrayed for the reward money. And something that I came across much later in Casanova's memoirs, if anybody wants a picture of 18th century Europe, I highly recommend Casanova's memoirs. Casanova was a real guy. He was a sort of a con man, adventurer, gambler, entrepreneur, literary figure, a whole bunch of different things, very talented guy, and he wrote this very readable set of memoirs when he was an old man. But one of the things he mentions during his visit in London was a sign you could see in the windows. I don't think he ever says what the words were, and if he has, I forgot. But which he asked his English friends what it meant, and they said it means perjury for sale here. So that there were people who were in it. What sign would you put in your window in modern day America if you wanted to advertise your availability for providing perjured testimony? There's important information. You may want to buy this at some future occasion as part of your professional. Very good. Expert witness here. You got it. But it's the same basic idea, right? It may not be literally perjured in that you're not testifying to false facts, but you're being hired to argue for, to give evidence for one side of the case. That's right. Other points, other comments, other things people want? Yeah.
Why did you say in your article you said that once it goes to trial, the prosecutor has very little control
to
judge them?
Yeah.
But what is that?
Well, the jury is the one that decides whether he's guilty or not. But my understanding of the system is this is a system without lawyers. That lawyers, I'm not sure if you ever have a lawyer in a case, but you certainly don't normally have our system of a lawyer on each side. And that therefore the sort of management of the case, you know, I guess things like who's allowed to testify, I've never seen one of these cases, I didn't live in the 18th century, that the case is being managed by the judge. The jury is there to make a decision, and therefore, in some issues, if you think about one of the things I was wondering about, I've never really gotten a clear answer, is what if two different people want to prosecute? But the answer might well be that the judge could say, all right, you're the prosecutor, but I'm going to call his witnesses, too.
Okay, you're talking about one hand and not control.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's what I was talking about. As in any of these, I may or may not be right, but that's what's going on. One other thing which I learned that was quite interesting in the process of researching this was the history of galley slavery. That the sort of standard version you get in American movies makes galley slavery a phenomenon of classical antiquity, that supposedly, you know, Romans are convicted of something and sentenced to row in the galleys. It turns out that isn't true. That galley slavery is a Renaissance invention. It's, I think, about 15th century, as I remember, that you get the first galley slaves in the sense of people who are convicted of a crime and sentenced to row a galley as the punishment. That in classical antiquity, they used rowed ships a lot, of course. And some of those ships might have had slave rowers. They might also have had slave captains. That, you know, slavery is quite common in classical antiquity. But they weren't people who were slaves because they had been sentenced to the galleys and punished for a crime, except in modern movies. And my theory, at least, of what's going on, and I'm not sure it's right, but I'll give it to you anyway because I like it, is that the reason you don't use galley slaves until about the 15th century is that until that time, naval warfare mostly consists of land warfare on board ship. If you think about a classical naval battle, it's boarding and fighting hand-to-hand. Certain amount of archery and such, but mostly boarding and fighting hand-to-hand. If the battle is going to be that kind of a battle, do you really want a crew that is disarmed, chained, and hates you? All right? Think about a Viking ship. All right? The people who are rowing the Viking ship are the Vikings, for good reason, because you want everybody there to be a warrior when it comes to a fight. And so my interpretation is that what makes galley slavery possible is the shift to the use of cannon at sea as a large part of naval warfare. That once your rowers are only the engine of your ship and not your army, now you don't care if they like you or not, or if they're armed. So that's my guess. But what we do know, apparently, from the book I was, the article I was able to find on it, is that galley slavery appears, and I think it's late 15th century, and I swear to that, I say what the date is somewhere in my footnotes, I think. And that at that point, Mediterranean powers stop executing able-bodied male prisoners and start sentencing them to the galleys instead. And if they don't have any galleys, they sentence them to row the galleys of some ally of theirs that does have galleys. I said Mediterranean powers because galleys don't work very well in the open ocean in the Atlantic. And so the English are not using galleys. Not they don't use it. I'm not claiming that no galley is ever used in the Atlantic, but they're a good deal more effective in the relatively calmer water of the Mediterranean. And part of what intrigued me about that, thinking about it as an economist, is that it suggests that prior to the invention of galley slavery, on average, prison labor didn't pay for itself. That you didn't make your serious criminals into slaves, essentially, didn't use penal servitude as a punishment, because guarding them and feeding them cost more than they would actually produce. Remember, we're talking about poor societies where the ordinary workman isn't producing much more than he consumes, and your criminal, it's true, you don't have to give him quite as luxurious a life as your serf, but serfs don't have very luxurious lives either. On the other hand, you have to guard him, which you don't have to do with a serf. So my guess of what's going on is that ordinary slavery just didn't pay for that kind of a potential slave, whereas galley slavery is easy to make sure the slaves are working because they're all rowing together and you can tell if somebody is slacking off and whip him, and you don't have to do much guarding because you're out in the middle of the Mediterranean, and if he could get off his chains and jump out, he'd drown anyway. So it was a relatively cost-effective form of penal slavery, and therefore became popular once it was an option. The English didn't have galleys, so they used transportation as their next best alternative, and we know that it was a net cost to them because they had to subsidize the transporting the prisoners, the convicts, even though they could then get auctioned off at the far end. Other comments, questions, things that interested people about that story? I put some figures up here because I mentioned earlier that I think it's worth, when you're looking at these societies, I mean, is this blocking this in the way for anybody? It's worth trying to figure out, when you actually have money figures, what they mean. And so the amount that you had to steal in order for your theft to be a non-clergible offense, a capital offense, was 40 shillings. The wage of a skilled laborer was about 33 shillings a week. So you're not talking about stealing a fortune. The dues for a prosecution association, the median was for at least somebody's study of them, was somewhere around 10 shillings a year. So It would have been a noticeable cost for a skilled laborer, but not out of bounds. It's not impossible that a skilled laborer could have afforded to join such a thing. For an agricultural laborer, anybody know how many shillings there are in the pound? 20. 20 shillings in the pound, 21 shillings in the sovereign. And 12 pence the shilling. I can see none of you were ever English schoolboys. I was. For a year. Anyway, so 39 pounds a year is a little less than a pound a week, so it's something which maybe 15, 16, 17 shillings a week. So the agricultural laborer is getting maybe half what the skilled laborer is getting. But I think when you're seeing these numbers, it's nice to have at least some very rough feel. Is 40 shillings, you know, like a buck for you? No. Is it like 5,000 bucks for you? Also no. It's sort of somewhere between that. And similarly for these other figures. So, yep.
Early in your article, you say that part of why the system was transitioned out of was because they perceived that there was a very high
crime
rate. And do you have a comparison of this?
I have some figures. I think they're in the footnotes for crime rates.
How they compare to, say, when Iceland?
I didn't compare that, but I do have some figures, I think, in the footnotes. I wouldn't rely on them very heavily because the basis for that is indictments for homicide. So if the system worked really badly, there might have been a lot of homicides that never made it to the court. But if you believe the indictment figures, what you have is a steep decline in the murder rate from 1660 to 1800. I think the figure, if I remember correctly, was it fell fourfold in rural areas and ninefold in urban areas. That's by memory, but I give the figure in the article so you can check it. And I also have a comparison between the situation around 1800 and the situation around 1900. I think that's in the footnotes, though I don't remember. And if you're willing to assume that indictments for homicide in the early period corresponds to murders known to the police in the later period, these aren't directly comparable statistics, then it looks as though the murder rate doesn't change very much from 1800 to 1900. Although you're replacing the private prosecution system with the public prosecution system. Now, as in most of these cases, you can't prove a whole lot from that. First, because you're not really sure the numbers are comparable. Second, because if I wanted to say, look, that shows how good private prosecution was, murder rate was declining under private prosecution, stopped declining, somebody could say, yeah, but look, other things were happening in the 19th century, which he might argue should have pushed the murder rate up, and only because of the virtues of public prosecution they didn't. So it's not easy to get clean answers to those things. But at least the very rough numbers I had suggested that the shift from the private to the public system didn't much change the murder rate, and that under the earlier private system, the murder rate had been falling. Now, there are some earlier figures which suggest that it had been falling for a long time. I think there are figures that go back to, I don't know, 12th or 13th century. Now, those, of course, are not national figures. Those are some one village where some historian did trying to calculate the murder rate. And it may well be that murders are something which tend to decline as societies get wealthier. That if you think about, you know, how hungry are you, that might affect how willing you are to take the risk of killing somebody to get something. But in any case, but I think it's clear, I think, that many people in the 18th century thought the system worked badly. On the other hand, many people in modern times think things about their own system which aren't really supported by the evidence. So that, I don't know, you may be better informed than the general public. What would you say about the pattern of the U.S. murder rate? Is it going up, going down, high, low, anything? Anyone know? U.S. murder rate is below half its peak. Its peak would be maybe 20 years ago or so, 20 or 30 years ago. It's still high by international standards compared to other rich countries, not high compared to some poor countries. But it's fallen quite steeply. And I'm not sure how many will know that. My impression is that, you know, in a sense, any murder rate is always bad. And if it happens that what's getting publicity is the fact that it's lower than last year, people think it's falling. If what's getting publicity is it's higher than in England, people say, oh, look how high it is. So I'm not sure I really trust that sort of contemporary stuff, especially since they had much worse data in the 18th century than we have now in order to build such opinions on. Yeah.
Wouldn't that perception be, I mean, now we have a lot of media, but we also have a huge country.
Yes.
Right, and depending on which channel you watch, you probably spell you very much better than that. Yeah. But if you talk about English society, you know, hundreds of years back, they all pretty much had access to the same information, right? So, and it's a smaller geographic area, probably, you know, can spread better?
Maybe. I'm not sure, because on the one hand, certainly the number of educated people who would be forming opinions on this would be a much smaller number than now. On the other hand, the communication media are much worse than they are now. Well, except that there wasn't a lot of information. Look, it seems to me even if you think about, you know, people in a family can disagree quite a lot about, you know, is this dog badly behaved? And so forth and so on. So I just don't know. I mean, it seems to me that they didn't. I mean, part of the virtue of the situation at the moment is that you can go up on the web and there's the statistical abstract of the United States. You can actually look up numbers, and they aren't perfect numbers, but they give you pretty good information for something. Despite that, I just had an op-ed that got published somewhere on the history of the Great Depression. And the reason I wrote it, well, not the reason I wrote it, but what I used as the hook for it, was that a Republican conservative who was attacking a different Republican conservative recently asserted as a fact that at the beginning of the Great Depression, Hoover sharply cut spending, and that was one of the reasons the Great Depression happened. Now, it happens that from 1929, when the stock market crash occurred, to 1932, which was Hoover's last budget, federal expenditures measured in dollars went up 50%. Federal expenditures measured in purchasing power went up 100%. And federal expenditures measured as a share of national income tripled. And yet, a prominent, you know, media figure takes it for granted that the opposite happened, and many people believe it. All right. So that's in a world where all you got to do is to go to the library and look up historical statistics of the U.S. and read the table.
That's right. Possible.
Yeah. And then he did the same thing Hoover did, essentially.
More and more spending, but he's remembered as the one who saved everything.
Yes.
Even though he continued the exact same pattern of behavior.
Yeah.
There's just some things that we don't think about.
But also, most.
But
there's a certain sense in which you have to. There's so much stuff out there that in practice all of us are taking a large part of our knowledge on faith because somebody we relied on told us, and only occasionally checking things up. Yep.
Can you ask us how we can access that op-ed or where?
Sure. If you did a search for my name and David Frum, who's the guy who I, since it got webbed, it was published, basically a friend of somebody I know who's much more into op-eds and stuff than I am, offered to find me an outlet after I had failed to get the Wall Street Journal to publish it, which I would have been delighted to do. And it was done by something called, I think, the Investor's Business Daily or something like that. But it's on the web, and if you look for my name and David Frum, that would probably find it. Or Great Depression in my name would probably find it, because it was pretty recent. And somebody else also wants to print it. I'm not quite sure what the rules are and whether the same op-ed can go in two different places or not. It's probably, I think that's one, there's probably in lots of places, so I don't know. Once something goes up on the web, if people are interested, you've got, you know, 18 different people reciting it. But I think the Investors Daily was the original source. It was, yeah, what was going on was David Frum was attacking Ron Paul's support of the gold standard, and Frum's claim was that the gold standard was the reason Hoover had to cut spending for reasons that aren't entirely clear. And my point is, well, if so, Hoover wasn't informed of that since he didn't cut spending, he raised it, and in any case, he raised spending, and therefore cutting spending can't be what caused the Great Depression. Now, the other bit which was fun in that piece, and I actually wrote it before the Frum thing, and then it just struck me as a good hook to use it, was having noticed the figures from 1920 to 1923, because Harding in 20 did precisely what Hoover was claimed to have done in 29. that you have what looks as though it might be the beginning of a big depression at the beginning of the 20s. Unemployment jumps like 8% in a year, as I remember, 6 or 8% in a year, and prices fall, and Harding sharply cuts federal spending, and by 23 it's all over.
And there's another great irony there.
But again, you can't draw conclusions with certainty for any of this stuff.
Right.
It could be that if Harding had raised spending, it would still have been over, maybe even over faster. It could be that if Hoover had cut spending, things in order. You can't know. All you can do is to say the basis of people believing X is wrong,
right,
and therefore that's some reason not to believe X. But you know, it's not like we really understand macroeconomics here. I don't think anybody does. My standard, it's not what I've ever done, but my standard view is that a course on macro is a tour of either a grave site or a construction site, either a graveyard or a construction site, because it's either old ideas that don't work or new ideas we aren't yet sure of. But it's not what I do. So anyway, that's a long digression. But the basic point is just that it's hard to get people to agree on the truth unless the truth is really important to them, unless it's easy to find out. And if you want to make speeches in Parliament about how terrible the crime rate is in 1770 or something, for one reason or another, you don't have a whole lot of incentive to do a lot of careful research to find out what the crime rate really is. But anyway, no, as in the Icelandic case, I don't know why things changed. I can offer some various guesses as to why things changed, and I think I do in that article. And, you know, one guess, the one that I originally started going with, was it was urbanization. That as the population gets denser, it's less likely that the criminal will know who the potential victim is, less likely he'll know if he's pre-committed to prosecute, and so forth. But then somebody else wrote a piece later, which I read, which argued, well, actually the system was working pretty well as you went into more urbanization. And they had local patrols paid for by something like a prosecution association or other arrangements. And then a different argument, and an interesting one, is that what's really going on is that the English have been scared by the French Revolution. After all, if you're an English nobleman, very wealthy, and you observe what's been going on by the guillotine in the late 18th century, you have reason to be worried. And one of the things that might occur to you is, if something like that starts happening here, how do we stop it? Well, calling in the army is it's a possible method. It's a pretty crude tool. But if we've got a whole bunch of people who are in the business of enforcing the law, well, cutting my head off is surely a violation of the law. We can use them to try to suppress the early stages or something like that. So that's another possible theory. Third argument, which is related to that, is the idea that something which pretty clearly is happening in this sort of early 19th century is that reforming people is becoming a more and more popular idea. And so if the reason we've got problems in England is that the lower classes don't really live decent, God-fearing, hard-working lives, they insist in going and getting drunk and fornicating and gambling and all sorts of things they shouldn't be doing, well, if the people who are enforcing law were working for us, we could do something about that. We could try to improve the morals of the poor. And that apparently, pretty clearly, is one theme going on again in sort of late 18th and more early 19th century. So it's sort of interesting from that standpoint. If you look at what's actually happening with criminal punishment in the early 19th century, there's a sense in which there are sort of two grand theories of criminal punishment, which, as far as I can tell, have existed forever, or at least for the last 200 or 300 years. And one of them is that you punish criminals so that rational people will choose not to be criminals if they don't want to be punished. And the other is, no, criminals are criminals till they're irrational. What you really want to do is to use the punishment system to remold them, to reform them. So you'll have a reform school where you reform kids and they realize that it was never a good idea to be a member of a gang or push drugs or do whatever they've been doing, that they really ought to go to school and work hard and maybe get a scholarship to Harvard and so forth. Similarly, penitentiaries are called penitentiaries because they're where you learn penitence. You learn to repent of your sins. And in the early 19th century, there was a large element of sort of preaching at people and teaching them skills and giving them solitary confinement so they could think and reflect upon their bunch of that kind of stuff going on. So part of what may be going on may be an ideological shift. That in a funny way, 18th century England looks more like sort of the modern economist's view of the world. That's the view of 18th century England. Looks more like the modern economist's view of the world than early 19th century does. In the sense that you have the impression that people more or less take it for granted, as a modern law and econ person would, that the reason a pickpocket is a pickpocket is not that he's crazy, it's not that he's uneducated, it's that it happens to be the best job available to him at the moment. And he's made it, you know, he knows the costs and benefits much better than you do, and he's made a calculation, and he said, well, I might hang, but I probably won't, and it'll put food on the table. And that, I think, seems to be the attitude running through a lot of the 18th century stuff, and much less, as I say, I think the early 19th century looks to me as though it's more the sort of what I would think of as a patronizing attitude, what other people would say was an empathetic attitude of saying the reason he's a pickpocket is he was beat up when he was a kid, he was abused by his parents, and he never got proper treatment, and nobody ever loved him, and so forth and so on. Now, surely there are some elements of both. There are people who do change as a result of, you know, a religious experience or education or whatever, and there are rational criminals who do actually figure out what's the sensible thing to do and do it. But in any case, I think that part of what's going on may be that shift as well as others. Let's see. Other things worth running through. I tried to make some very rough estimates on the prosecution associations, and I think I say something in the text. I don't remember if I actually give my calculations, but the figures that we have a couple of figures for particular years for somebody's count of prosecution associations, so that there was a. One source says that in 1839 there were at least 575 prosecution associations. He thinks that's an underestimate. They didn't get them all. So that the numbers suggest that that one association would typically have 20 to 60 members. Presumably the member would be the head of a family, so that really, if you're thinking about total population, might represent 5 or 6 or 7 people. And if you run those numbers through, it suggests that maybe as 400,000 people at a time were members of families that were customers of prosecution associations. The population of England is about 12 million. So you're talking about roughly 3% of the population, something like that, being protected in that particular way. And again, that's a very, very, very rough number. That's what we sometimes refer to as a back-of-the-envelope calculation. But nonetheless, it tells you that it wasn't most people and it wasn't practically nobody. And presumably, poor people mostly didn't have that much likely to get stolen and would regard even 10 shillings a year as a serious cost. And presumably, at least some rich people could make their own arrangements outside of the association. Think of what other things I had here that I wanted to mention. I guess one point, if you're thinking in the context of a modern society, is that one of the changes happening was more newspapers, better communication, that sort of stuff, and that one has gone much further in the modern world. So that one could imagine something like those prosecution associations in a modern society where you post up on the internet a description of your stolen property, a reward for its return, and so forth. And as part of the stuff in my other seminar, I did come across sort of some interesting stories of victims of crimes getting together through the internet and successfully tracking down the offenders. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, this is the particular story which I came across, in fact, which I actually found through the net as well, involved somebody who was selling, I think it was an Apple laptop, but a fair while ago, fairly expensive thing, and it turned out he was paid with a bogus check. And I'm not even sure how much of the internet, I'm not sure how much of the web existed, the internet existed, but he sort of put a bunch of stuff up on bulletin boards trying to get help for locating the person who had cheated him, and eventually got in touch with a number of other people who had been victims of the same person. And one of the people he got in touch with, I don't think a victim, put him in touch with a place where he could get from a cell phone number to an address, because he had a cell phone number for the guy. And some other, and he then, it looked as though it was in Chicago, so he tried to contact, I think, the FBI, somebody else, the Chicago police, none of whom were interested. And eventually some people who were part of his internet contacts in Chicago gave him more detailed information. No, it was actually a Chicago suburb. And he got in touch with the police there, and he finally found a police who was actually interested in catching criminals. And so the police, the victim set up he claimed to have another laptop to auction on the same terms. Put it up in the same way the same guy did. Sends him the empty package. And the delivery man is a policeman in a UPS uniform. And they caught the guy with a whole bunch of basically bogus, I don't know what the bank drafts, I don't know what the form was, whatever he was using to make such payments. So that was an interesting case, and it made me sort of wonder to what extent modern technology might make private enforcement a more viable system than in the past.
I heard a similar story with someone who lived in Los Angeles and left his golf club in his car with his good friend for dinner or something, and he came back, the golf clubs were gone, probably sold. He came back up here to Santa Clara and watched that neighborhood's listings on Craigslist until the golf club showed up. He got the phone number, and then he ended up getting in touch with the police in Los Angeles, who were entirely uninterested.
Yes.
And he said that they reacted basically just stupidly. They said, well, how do you know that this is the guy who was not my golf club?
Yeah.
They just didn't even respond to that. But eventually he set up some sort of sting or something, and I think he got everything back, but all privately done.
Yeah.
Because the police were so interested in.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a sense, part of the fun of looking at different ways things have been done is thinking about would the various things they did work. Now, you don't know for sure, but I think it's a good deal better than saying the only way you can do things is however we're doing it yesterday. I've also wondered with regard to particular internet crimes whether one could set up some kind of equivalent where when I'm hacking into your computer, one of the things I get is a message saying, by the way, this computer is a customer of, Bring 'em Back Dead or Alive Incorporated, and they'll go after you if you hack into this computer. But I don't know some of that happens, of course, if you think about things. If you're a member of the AAA, I think one of the things they provide is a sticker that goes on your car, which basically says reward for information leading to recovery of this car. Things of that sort. So, let me look through my notes to see what we haven't covered that might interest people. I want to say a little bit about the whole issue of punishment efficiency, which is sort of an interesting, at least to me, an interesting issue. That one of the puzzles, which I actually have a different article on and also spend some time in one of my books, is why modern legal systems use such inefficient punishments. Because if you think about it, I'm thinking of efficiency as the ratio of the amount of punishment which is relevant to deterrence, how much you're hurting the person you're punishing versus how much it costs. So that if you execute somebody, in some sense, punishment cost is one life, it's paid by him, so the cost is equal to the amount of the punishment. If you lock somebody up, the cost is more than the amount of the punishment. You've got both the cost to him of being locked up and the cost to you of paying for the prison. On the other hand, if you can collect a fine, now cost is much less than the amount of punishment because the money he loses, somebody else gets. Similarly for tort damages. Now, it's more complicated because the tort damages, you really ought to think about the cost of the trial and convicting him and so forth as well. But you think about punishment, it looks as though fine is more efficient than execution, and execution is more efficient than imprisonment. So one of the ways, I think, in the book that I sort of started is I said, I've got this proposal for improving our legal system. It's an unambiguous improvement. It goes as follows. We have some crime for which we now condemn people to 10 years in prison. And by doing suitable research, we discover that criminals are indifferent between 10 years in prison and one chance in six of being hanged. You have to know obviously the taste of the criminals to say, suppose you could do this. I say, well, all right, my improvement goes as follows. We do everything the way we used to do, except that after you convict someone of this crime, instead of locking him up for 10 years, you roll a die. 1 to 5, you send him home. 6, you hang him. And I say, well, look, from the standpoint of the criminals, this is no worse than the previous system. That some of them win, some lose, but on average, they're getting the same punishment. From the standpoint of potential victims, it's no worse because you've got the same amount of deterrence, because it's equivalent. And we're saving lots of money on prisons, so why isn't this a good idea? Now, one possible answer, which is a legitimate answer but not a very interesting one, is that one advantage of locking someone up is that while he's in jail, he probably can't do any more burglaries. Of course, when he's dead, he can't do it either, but we're only hanging 1/6 of them and we're locking up all of them, so it's sort of got a complicated incapacitation calculation. But I think there are more interesting issues, and one of the more interesting issues has to do with the disadvantage of efficient punishments, especially if you push the argument a little bit further. And after I thought about this and did an article on it, I discovered that a science fiction author named Larry Niven had seen the basic problem long before I did and made some stories out of it. And Niven's story starts out with a pseudo-history, a little bit in the future when he was really writing, in which it occurs to people what a terrible waste it is to execute people and bury them in a world where there's always a shortage of organs for transplants. And so some country or other passes a new law which says that if somebody is executed for a capital crime, his organs forfeit to the state and can be used for transplant. Now that certainly sounds like an enlightened, sensible thing. You're going to save human lives by having organs available. You can get much better organs when you harvest them from somebody while you kill them than you would if you had to take them out of a dead body. What do you think the next step is? In a world where there are never... What? In a world where there are never enough organs for transplant, there is now political pressure to expand the range of capital offenses. And in the Niven story, which is, I think, the first story in this series, at the end of the story, you discover that the viewpoint character, who is in jail waiting execution, has been convicted of, for the third time, driving in such a way as to endanger human life. So three reckless driving, and you're out. It's three strikes. Yep?
Yes, I was thinking when you were talking about the dice.
Yes.
I think instead of enhancements, you could get higher chances.
That's right.
And if the equivalent of 10 years is 1 in 6, then what's the equivalent of 20 or 30 or 40 years?
Might be 1 in 12, 1 in 15.
Your odds of rolling the dice are...
But putting it differently, you could adjust that system to get any punishments you wanted. But the point that I sort of got into is you want to think not only about the incentives of the criminal, but about the incentives of the law enforcement system too. And the more efficient your punishment system is, the greater the incentive to punish people whether or not they're guilty, or to punish them more severely than is necessary or whatever, which is in a sense part of Niven's point in the story. And so, you know, I sort of, in the chapter in Law's Order, I sort of run through the quite ugly result that you get if you're trying to get an optimally efficient system, and then suggest that one reason we don't want to do it is it might give the wrong incentives, not to the criminals, but to the people making and enforcing the laws.
That's presupposing also that there is an unlimited demand and an unlimited willingness to do whatever is necessary.
Well, but in my version, I am assuming that we've already decided what level of punishments we want to impose. I'm just shifting to imposing them in more efficient ways. Right? Now, I should say you could make it still more efficient by letting him buy out. Suppose we say, look, a fine is more efficient than execution, even though execution is more efficient than imprisonment. And the problem with the fine is that the right fine for your crime is $100,000, and you don't have $100,000. But you've got some money, and maybe you've got friends who can raise money, so tell you what, for every $10,000 that you're willing to contribute, we're willing to raise it from a 6-sided die to a 7-sided die to an 8-sided die to a 9-sided die. So you could imagine a system of that sort. And, I mean, you can think of lots of other things. I mean, corporal punishment is more efficient than imprisonment too, so you have flogging and not as efficient as fines. And you think about penal slavery again. And partly I got into this because a long, long time ago I was, actually after I did my Icelandic stuff, I was thinking about whether in a modern society you could have a system where instead of saying you're sentenced to 2 years in jail, we say your punishment is 2 years or $40,000. And what do we mean by that if you don't have $40,000? If you don't have $40,000, you can go into a private prison where you're essentially slave labor. And you can go to the public prison for 2 years, but we give you the alternative of any private prison that will guarantee you don't escape. And they make you an offer. They say, look, work in our prison and you'll pay off your fine in 1 year. And that looked to me like a pretty obviously good system. And somebody who I mentioned this online said, yeah, you know, the European colonialists had a version of this system. When they wanted a road built, they would find some excuse to arrest a bunch of the natives and then sentence them to road building. And that suggested that although there are some very attractive features that I'm describing, there's also a very dangerous feature, which is that because you've made it profitable to convict people, you've created an incentive to convict people whether or not they're guilty. And they were using road building, yeah. Well, the other one that I came across, I may have mentioned it earlier, is sort of a less grim version of the same problem as a story H.O. Mencken has somewhere. Did I tell you the story already about the sheriff somewhere or other who liked to have his jail nice? So once every year he would send his deputies out to the bars and say, I want one carpenter, one plumber, and one painter. And they would find some excuse, because you know people in bars are often doing this unruly things, to arrest one carpenter, one plumber, and one painter, and they'd stay in the jail for a couple of days fixing up his jail for him, and then he turned them loose. And you know, it's not as unpleasant, but it's the same basic problem. So it does seem to me it's one of the features you want to think about in any system, is the incentives to those making and enforcing the laws, as well as the incentives to those who are breaking the laws who may not want to break it. So in any case, that then gets me into this whole the galley slavery stuff. Thinking about galley slavery as having been a relatively efficient form of punishment, and it would be an interesting question to ask whether, when galley slavery became an option, the result was that states became more willing to convict people. Did they broaden the category of capital offenses or offenses the guy who sentenced to the galleys on the grounds that we could now actually use some more rowers in our galleys? And I don't know, but you could certainly imagine that having happened. So in any case, in the English case, I think the evidence suggests that the cheapest form of punishment short of execution was transportation. That it looks as though it was cheap. We've got some evidence on penal slavery, not very good evidence, but we do know that during the period after 1776, for some reason, those unruly colonists wouldn't accept the transportees anymore. They took people they would have transported and used them for doing prison labor on Thames works, on improvements on the River Thames. I don't know what the details were. Imprisoning them in hulks, that is to say, in floating ships moored in the Thames, and that was considered a failure. I think it's pretty clear that what that meant was that it cost more than the work was worth. And I had suggested some evidence that the same thing was true in France, though we don't really know as clearly what was going on there. And so that then suggests that probably the cheapest way, if they didn't want to execute people, was to transport them. Now, they may also, there may have been other benefits. The English crown may have said, besides, they're going to serve out their term, and that's that many more Englishmen in our colonies in the New World, make it harder for the Spanish to steal the colonies from us, improves the power of England, and so forth. And whereas hanging people, we can't make any further use of them. But all of that is sort of a guess of what's going on. So going back to the pardoning, as I say, it seemed to me that you could interpret the pardoning either as an attempt to fine-tune the punishment system by saying, this guy is a real problem, hang him, this guy we've scared out of his wits, he's going to be good, send him home, or you can interpret it as a sort of a market of political influence in which people, you're doing favors for people and expecting favors in return. And I expect both are to some extent happening at the same time. And of course, a different or a related element, which I also suggest, is that you can think of the willingness of people to try to persuade you to pardon someone as some evidence of how much he's worth to other people. That if he's, you know, if the people in his village say, look, we're going to have to support his wife and kids if you hang him, and besides, he was a useful member of the community, even if he once in a while got drunk and did things he shouldn't do, you're more willing to pardon that guy than the one for whom nobody will say that sort of thing. So, trying to think of what else.
Because anything else I really had to say, do you have questions, comments? Have you thought of any new ideas for other people to do papers on during the course of the last hour or so?
Yes.
What?
Oh, no, well, actually not in the last hour. But, yeah. I was thinking about it over spring.
Yeah.
But okay. I have Hawaiian law.
For you or for somebody else?
For me.
Ah, all right. That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. No, I have Native Hawaiian law. If you've got the sources,
yeah,
that would be fun.
Yeah, I actually wrote a few professors that Native Hawaiian.
Yes, yes. I did, I have had at least one paper on New Zealand Maori law, which you might want to look at, because that's at least a distantly related culture, in some sense, the same civilization.
I've seen more on land titles and how that kind of stuff has been passed.
Yes.
Because that makes more sense with, like, sovereignty.
And people litigate it nowadays because they.
I've actually come to stumble across a couple of websites about, like, how the U.S. is, like, occupying Hawaii and how they should be.
Yes.
I mean, that's not the general feeling.
Yes. Sure. But in any case, you know, if you can find the information, and as I say, you may want to look at other information on related cultures. If you're sufficiently interested, I've got a book called The Economics of the New Zealand Maori, which actually has a good deal of stuff on their institutions. But I've already had one paper on that, so don't really know. But Hawaii would be neat. So are you from Hawaii?
No.
No, but you know people.
I have friends from there, and I
love it. Great, yeah, that'll be fine. But now find up another one so that somebody else who doesn't have one can steal in.
Okay, well,
first, but anyway, sure. But think about it. That is, if you don't have one, think hard. And if you do have one, anything that occurs to you, tell people.